From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made every time someone asks a friend or a family member, "Hey, you're married now. When are you having kids?" It's a question that can be painful or totally out of bounds for many reasons, but the editor of New York Magazine poses another wrinkle for people who are thinking about having children, or thinking about having more children. David Wallace Wells writes that climate change is a new and difficult consideration for many people. And his piece is titled, "Parenting the Climate Change Generation." He writes, quote, "Over the last year or two, the question I've been asked more than any other by people who know that I write about warming concerns," let me start over because I was terrible reading by the host. David writes following, quote, "Over the last year or two, the question I've been asked more than any other by people who know that I write about warming concerns kids, whether it's moral to reproduce in this climate, whether it's responsible to have children, whether it is fair to the planet, or perhaps more important, to the children." End quote. David Wallace Wells is not the first to pose these questions in print. There have been prominent pieces recently in a range of publications addressing whether to have children at all, whether climate change is inescapable, whether it's almost abusive to have kids when the climate is changing this much, what to tell our kids about climate change, and more. So this hour, we're discussing climate change and parenting. Has it impacted your views on whether it's a good idea to have children or more children? Our guests this hour include Neely Kelly, the New York senior organizer for Mothers Out Front, mother of two. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Evan.
Also with us is Wendy Lowe, who is a climate activist with Mothers Out Front and the Rochester People's Climate Coalition, mother of one. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
And on the line with us is Larkin Posedlick, who is a mother and director, the executive director of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Steuben County. Larkin, thanks for taking the time. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Evan. I'm doing great.
I know we've all had a chance to read the piece now, and Larkin, for you, what goes through your mind when you read this piece about parenting the climate change generation and these considerations about our kids, about what they're facing, about couples who are or people who are thinking about having kids at all?
Mm-hmm. You know, I have to say that I hadn't read the article. I had seen it and had sort of put it out of mind. Like, I'm not sure I want to think about this any more than I already have until you sent it. And I'm really glad I did, because it's very thought-provoking. We have one child, a boy who's about a year and a half old, and we have grappled with this question a little bit more as a thought question, a conversation starter in our household, than a real practical thing, because we've already had one kid and we will likely have another. But my husband, who is a bit more the cynic in the relationship where I'm the optimist, has been the one who said, "Is it really responsible for our kids and the planet to do that?" I thought that I liked that the article ended on a high note, you know, that it was really talking about that this can be the generation who either makes things worse, but it really can be the generation that makes things better. And it's on us as parents to raise that generation of kids to make things better and more livable.
It did end on a much more optimistic note than I perhaps thought when I began reading the piece by David Wallace Wells, which we will post on our various platforms if you'd like to take a look at the piece, Parenting the Climate Change Generation. Neely, what went through your mind in reading that piece?
Well, when I first read it, it really resonated with me. I, too, had seen it and had avoided reading it.
I'm so glad Connections can drag you into reading pieces you don't want to grab.
Yeah, thank you. But then I read it a second time, and I realized that the worldview and the perspective that this particular article brings is one of foreign of people of privilege who have the time and the space to care about this issue that's going to affect all of us in ways we really, many of us, can't imagine at the moment. And so I think it's really important to recognize that all the issues in our society and our world that are facing us right now and facing children, people across the planet, are being and will continue to be exacerbated by this issue. And I think it's really important, especially for people who are white, privileged, middle class, middle upper class, to really recognize how important the issues of racism, poverty, segregation, police brutality are, now, and just remember that. Like, it's easy. For a long time, you know, I was just like, oh my God, climate change. Everyone has to do something about climate change right now. And I've been doing a lot of work around racism and segregation and oppression, and have really come to realize that is equally, if not more, important if we are going to solve the greatest crisis to face humanity ever.
Yeah, I think just to follow up on that point, Neely, the way I hear it distilled often, and I'm hearing this sort of the echoes here in your sentiments to open this hour, are that number one, sort of generally speaking, if you have wealth, you've got the time and the resources to consider your carbon footprint to begin with. If you are living in poverty, you know, you are trying to get by, you're trying to survive, you're trying to take care of children or your family, and that, you know, your carbon footprint and how you get around and what you're consuming isn't necessarily at the top of the list for understandable reasons. So that boils down to begin with there. So just inequality, where wealth concentrates in the hands of a few at the top, can exacerbate climate change for that reason. And then when you have other societal inequalities that you're sort of listing out, that requires focus and attention that takes time and effort, possibly, away from climate activism. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. So all of the different ways that we have this sort of inegalitarian society impact climate change at a time where we need to be putting our attention on it, which I think is a fair and important point, and I've already gotten another email to that effect, so I'm glad you brought that up. So I think we recognize there's some privilege to the conversation about this, and I think that's fair.
And the one thing I want to add too is the carbon footprint of, you know, it is the carbon footprint of the poor and the marginalized is significantly less than the wealthy. So I just wanted to make that point.
No question. Would it, again, this hypothetical is obviously always difficult, but if you were sort of rethinking having children and you didn't have children, and even in the last 6 months, we have more information. In the last 6 years, we have more information, let alone a decade. Do you think your own views on having children might have changed?
Absolutely.
You do?
Absolutely, yeah.
That's a tough statement.
And I think that, you know, and I was telling Wendy before the program, what I've seen over the last 5 or 6 years is a change in willingness to admit that and to talk about it. And when I would say something to that effect, you know, well, A, for a long time, I was really hesitant. You know, I've been in Mothers Out Front's about 6 years old. I've been involved from the very beginning. And, you know, it was always kind of at the back of my mind. And, you know, it was kind of one of the elephants in the room. but as I've noticed, after a certain period of time, I started saying things similarly. Like, I really would, you know, if I were younger or what have you, I would really reconsider this. Reconsider is not the exact right word, but it would factor into that decision. But since, you know, for the last 6 years, in over time, in that short period of time, I have noticed more of a willingness of young people to really say, no, I cannot have children, you know, because of what I know is coming for climate change. And they're talking about it. And then I know plenty of people who know about climate change, and they see hope in having children. And I have to really, I think we are really, again, privileged in this country to have the choice, mm-hmm. And have the resources for many people to have the resources at our disposal to make that decision. And for me, it's so incredibly personal that I, you know, really respect and honor everybody's choice in that matter. So
I think that's very direct. Listeners, if you want to join the program as we talk about parenting in the climate change generation, you can call the program toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling in Rochester, 263-9994. Email the program, connections@WXXI.org. Wendy, how did you feel about the piece?
The thing that occurred to me after reading the piece was a really strong feeling of, I work a lot with kids all my life, and I didn't have a child till I was 43. And yes, I had my child, blessedly, a year or two before Inconvenient Truth came out. So I can say to my child, I didn't know this was going to happen. Maybe if I'd been paying more attention. But I'm really worried about people worrying about having children, and then when they do have children, putting the burden of the knowledge of how much we're screwing up the planet on those children. Mm. I'm really worried about the anxiety of that when it is our responsibility. And I also wonder about the one-child syndrome, because I have an only child, and that's partly an accident of when I had my child. But it's also, I mean, I could have adopted or whatever. And I look at things like China, where they're supposed to be communists, and their values are all supposed to be communal, and they're this whole nation of only children. So if we're going to reduce the number of children we have, and we want it to be good for the planet, I think teaching our children compassion and giving them ways to people to fight fair with, like you do with your with your siblings, giving that if we're going to raise a generation that is going to do the things necessary, the sharing, the reducing their own desires, then we need not to spoil this next generation, but we also need not to put the huge burden of anxiety of, oh, guess what, you have to fix the planet.
Yeah, that is that's a really salient point when you think about some of the psychological baggage that may come with. So before we jump to your phone calls, and we've already got the phones lit up and the emails coming in, I just want to turn back to Larkin for a moment, because Larkin invoked the fact that the article that we're discussing, Parenting in the Climate Change Generation, does end on a more optimistic note. I want to read a little bit of what the author said there. David Wallace Wells writes a lot about climate to begin with, but he talks about having a child in his mid-30s and how, you know, things... Even his own knowledge of the reality of climate change was different even in these recent short years. So he writes the following quote. Part of our choice was delusion, the same willful blindness that allowed us to grow into our mid-30s in America, mostly blind to the way our lives and purchases and travel and diets were polluting the futures of our children and their children, and indeed the futures of everyone they might ever meet on this planet. I now know there are climate horrors to come, some of which will inevitably be visited on my kids. This is what it means for warming to be an all-encompassing, all-touching threat. But I also know that those horrors are not yet scripted. We are staging them by inaction, and by action can stop them. Climate change means some bleak prospects for the decades ahead, but I don't believe the appropriate response to that challenge is withdrawal, surrender. I think you have to do everything you can to make the world accommodate the life you want to have for yourself and your family, rather than giving up early before the fight has been lost or won, and acclimating yourself to a dreary future brought into being by others less concerned about climate pain. The fight is definitively not yet lost. End quote. Is that how you feel, Larkin?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's funny. I got into my office this morning and I turned to the newest page of my 2019 page-a-day calendar, and the quote was from Isaac Asimov, better to make a good future than predict a bad one, which I thought was so appropriate for this conversation. I, like Wendy, think that there is a balance of putting a burden on our children, but also raising our children to be able to handle this burden that they inevitably will have to deal with. If we're raising kids who are cooperative and generous and love the natural world and practice reciprocity, then those are the skills that they're going to need for tackling climate change. There was also a line in the article about that every decade follows could contain more suffering or less. And I'm optimistic, I think, that we can raise that generation that can help us get to less suffering rather than more. I got pregnant shortly before the 2016 election, and so when I went to vote in 2016, I went with an enormous amount of hope with my child, and things changed really quickly, of course, and it was very strange to have conceived a child in a world where I thought things were going to be different and a little bit more hopeful than I did just a few short months later.
Hmm. All right. A lot to sort of sort through here as we talk about parenting in the climate change generation. And let me grab some of your feedback, which I think will help us move the conversation in different directions. Miles from Rochester first on the phone. Go ahead, Miles.
Hi, thank you, Mike. I just want to put out there, my ex-wife and I, 25 years ago, made the decision to have only one child. And that was based on, you know, what we called at the time zero population growth, and, you know, tied directly into the climate and the impact that we humans are having on it, and our feeling that there are just too darn many of us. And we worked, you know, through the years to raise our son in a manner that is respectful of the environment and with awareness of climate change and his abilities to affect change at a local level.
Miles, let me just jump in and just say, call us back on the phone just if it's a little clearer. You're kind of in and out, and I want to make sure we can hear your call. So please give us a call back, 844-295-TALK. And listeners, as we talk about your views on parenting or raising kids at all, as we fully understand climate change, or at least, I don't know if we'll ever fully understand it, but we understand it more urgently, 844-295-TALK. The impetus for this conversation was a piece by journalist David Wallace Wells, who wrote a piece called Parenting for the Climate Change Generation. Let me read a couple of emails. Rachel writes to us and says, I'm in my early 30s, and this is a rather lengthy email, but I think there's a lot here, so I'm gonna work through this. She says, I'm in my early 30s, and there isn't a day that goes by where I don't struggle with this conundrum. I've had to recognize that it's a very privileged debate to have, that is generally had among white middle-class women. I say generally because this is certainly not always the case. I completely agree with the article that the future isn't written or decided yet. All we'd need to do as a society is truly dedicate ourselves to one another and make the systemic changes needed while simultaneously letting go of many frivolous distractions of wedge issues that divide us. We talk so much about rights in this country, but we don't talk nearly enough about responsibilities, especially those we have to all other humans and all other life on the only planet we have to support our existence. By that I mean that I promise not to give up on you or myself, and that I will continue to do whatever is within my control to make a systemic positive difference for our future. I think about the Serenity Prayer often, but the wisdom to know the difference between what is and what is not within my control is the crux. I've realized that for the systemic changes we need, nothing less than diverse and broad solidarity is required to weather the storms of climate change effectively. Humanity cannot survive as isolated individuals trying to make changes because systemic changes are essential. So cooperation and coordination are essential. If humanity needs a common foe to unite us, perhaps climate change is the best candidate. All that said, I always assumed I would have children, and I do still want a family, but I've been struggling daily with whether I can give myself permission. I've been thinking seriously about adoption. There are so many children who are already here that need love and a home. Why would I make more from scratch? But unfortunately, adoption is expensive, and I'm not sure my partner and I can afford it up front. All of this will continue to swirl around in my mind. That is from Rachel, and a lot there. Neely, I'll start with you. What do you make of that email?
I think she sums it up brilliantly. You know, it despair, and David Wallace Wells mentions this in his article as well, like the antidote to despair is action. And I, you know, will take the opportunity to encourage listeners, anyone out there, to really look, you know, a lot of people have the privilege of not engaging. They're busy daily lives, you know, kids, school, work, etc. And I think just find one thing to devote time or money or both to start creating. Or I shouldn't say start because we're on that path. I believe we are on that path. If I didn't, I would just sort of pack up and head out into the woods or whatever. But I think, you know, just find something to engage in to start creating or to continue and contribute to creating that world we want our children, all children, to inherit. And I'd love to say a lot more, but I'll stop there.
Well, I want to follow up with one point with you, because you've been on this program before talking about the work that you and your organization have done on alternative energies, things like wind energy, just as one example. And you've seen the way communities can be divided over issues. So Rachel emails and says she doesn't think we're going to solve this if it's just individuals trying to do their part in their house. That this is systemic, and it requires probably political will that we don't currently have. It requires cooperation that's not currently happening. It requires some sort of commonality that makes us all come together and say, we acknowledge the threat. We don't all have to like each other. We don't all have to agree on everything, but we must work together on this. And you, even on the community level, you've seen how divisive it can get. How do we get past that division?
It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of work, a lot of commitment, a lot of dedication. I think the story, or the historical story about the prohibition movement sort of sums up how that can happen, in that it was started, I believe, in the late 1800s as a way to stop violence against women. The founders of the movement saw alcohol as the root of violence against women and children and the reasons for destruction of the breakdown of communities. And so, forget her name now, but this woman traveled something like 90,000 miles a year by rail to go from community to community to community. And she would gather all the women together and she would say, we are going to solve this by, you know, doing three things. One, make concrete change in your own home. Stop drinking. Don't, you know, no alcohol in your own home. Two, organize collectively in your community to go shut down Joe's bar. And then three, when we have national legislation, national action that will prevent alcohol, you know, make alcohol illegal, we will all get behind that to ban it. Now, you know, let's not talk about whether, you know, the impact or effect of prohibition, but the approach is, you know, the community organizing approach is figuring out how to work together to achieve goals while recognizing that individual changes are also necessary. It's not everything. So does that
I think so. Whether we like prohibition or not, I think it's a way that there's sort of a model that was set there for individual change, but also for sort of collective and systemic change.
Exactly.
Okay. Very interesting. And wow, there's a lot of email already. Wendy, what did you make of Rachel's email?
Well, absolutely. We need one of the things I want to point out to people is that if you have a heart for children, you should be out with children. You should be among children. And there are many ways to do that. And secondly, a lot of the people I know who are environmentalists do care about the next generation. Some are very much about nature and wilderness, but many do care. And having their own children or not, caring about the next generation is probably a really important thing we're looking for in people who will step forward and make these changes and help us to make these changes. And frankly, people I know who come from other countries look at our culture and say, we don't really actually encourage people to grow up in our country. Okay? I know a lot of adults who are not adults, and I count myself among them. I am not fully an adult. I hope to be an adult by the time I die. But we need to grow up and face that we have real responsibilities for what's going on in our society and what comes next. And consumer culture encourages us to be forever children. It encourages us to be distracted and entertained and to buy the next little toy. And so I'm happy to work with people who are really interested in taking responsibility, but I think if people are going to have children, that's where I want to see them, is admitting this is a problem and contributing to the solution.
I think fair enough. Let's get back to your phone calls. Rob, next up on the phone. Go ahead, Rob.
Hi, Evan. I've been on the show a couple of times with Citizens Climate Lobby, and we talked about this a little bit when the Environmental Innovation Act came out, but my daughter is recently married. She's 31 years old, and we had this conversation at Thanksgiving on whether she and her husband, you know, thought that bringing children into this world was a responsible thing, and she was literally in tears. And so, you know, I talked to her and her husband about it, and I said, you know, the world has always faced at times what are seemingly insurmountable problems, and yet humanity has always found a way to get through it. And climate change may create a very different world from what we're living in today, but humanity will survive, and hopefully it will continue to thrive beyond that. So what I told her was, you and your husband are going to be great parents, and what the world will always need is quality people, and quality people come from quality families, and that they should base their decision on whether they feel they can bring quality people into the world. And I don't know what their decision is yet. They haven't said so. But I think if you're going to, you know, rely on hope for the future, hope is always with the children. And so whether you're privileged or not, quality people are always necessary to our society, and that those that are willing to create and raise responsible children, I think, should do so.
Rob, thank you.
That's all I have to say.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the phone call. That, you know, that sort of brings me back to where Larkin's mindset is. Is she thinks about having one child and thinks about having more. I guess, Larkin, if we have gotten to the point where we give up, that climate change is going to make this an uninhabitable planet real soon, and there's no work that can be done to sort of put any sort of brake on that, then I think there's a much more salient conversation about whether having children is a form of child abuse. But I don't know that giving up is what I'm hearing from even the most grim views of what's going on. What do you think about Rob's phone call, Larkin?
That all is lost. I think that there still can be things that can be done, and it takes a systems approach where raising responsible children is just part of it. In addition to what Wendy and Neely were talking about, that we need policy, we need grassroots activism. If we can approach climate change with a systems approach where environment and public health and raising responsible humans is all built in together, and at least those of us with privilege, if not everyone, can get behind that. I think, you know, we talk a lot about being people of privilege and that we have the time and the energy and the resources to care about this. We also have an opportunity that we can take the lead on fighting climate change with our privilege and bringing everyone along with us. The Robin Wall Kimmerer, who writes Braiding Sweetgrass, we are fortunate enough that she is my mother and the grandmother to my children. In her book, she writes that all flourishing is mutual. And I think the same goes for all suffering. But that if we, you know, if we raise one ship, we raise all of them or what have you. That I think if we can use our privilege and a real systematic approach to looking at climate change across the board, then we can make a difference. And all is not lost, and then hopefully we don't have to have those conversations about whether or not it is truly moral or child abuse to bring children into a world that is going to see so much suffering.
Let me work through more of the emails before we get our only break of the hour. A lot of feedback on this subject. Susan writes to us and says, "The question on whether to have children or not is a tough one. We owe it to all of the children of the world to keep working to reduce the carbon output. These times challenge us to work ourselves and to teach our children that we all can be part of the solution. People in the disenfranchised portions of our world need to be given access to concrete solutions. Working together is a huge issue, and we need to be working together with respectful, intelligent, non-threatening ways, as well as working on our own, in our own homes." That's from Susan. And then I'm hearing from a number of people who are invoking previous generations and how they viewed the crisis of their day. And I want to read a couple of emails and ask our guests if they view climate change in the same light or if they think it's kind of different now. So let me go ahead and read from Rick. He says, "As I listen to the discussion about the article about having children, given the reality of climate change, I can't help but think about the fact that the same question came up when I was a teenager and the threat of all-out nuclear war between the United States and the USSR seemed a real possibility. I recall talk about the immorality of bringing children into a world in which extreme poverty existed. So the question is not necessarily new, only the catalyst for the question is different." Rick does say, "I wholeheartedly agree with the panelists who are focusing on the positive possibilities which the next generation can create. After all, we not only did avoid all-out nuclear war, but we began working on reducing the threat. And extreme poverty has been reduced significantly. The real question should be, How should we raise our children and the next generation so that they will work to remediate the problems our generation has failed to resolve? And Lisa says, concern about having children has always been a concern. Children in the 1960s hid under desks for fear of nuclear war. In biblical times, the rabbis said that Moses' parents did not want to bring children into the world under a cruel pharaoh. Suffering is part of life, so is the joy. That's from Lisa. So a couple things there, and I'll turn to Neely first on this. So Lisa and Rick are both saying, hey, when nuclear war looked inevitable, these same questions came up. Should we even have kids at all if this is the world we're going to bring them into? And we worked on that, and that we can do the same with climate change. I think there is a parallel to an extent, and I think the point is decently well taken. I also think Rick's email concludes with an important point. Adults love to say, oh, kids these days. Oh, millennials, who are not kids anymore, by the way. They're all adults. Or Gen Z or whatever. But adults, may, probably me included, need to be accountable for the world we're leaving to kids, again, as Wendy said, without overburdening them with the anxiety of what that means. So is this problem, climate change, different, Neely, than you think possible nuclear war or other problems in previous generations have been?
So I do think it's, I think the problem is different because, I mean, one of the challenges with climate change is not really knowing how bad it's going to get. Like there, you know, a lot of the things that scientists 10, 15 years ago, more recent than that, were predicting wouldn't happen until the end of this century are happening now. And it's happening faster, it's happening bigger than had been predicted. And I do think the threat to life on Earth is more... I think it's more and harder to stop than the threat of nuclear war and all out nuclear annihilation. But I think the similarity is in the mindset. You know, I grew up in the 80s and the 90s, and so there was some remnants of the Cold War then. I don't remember hiding under desks. But the mindset of all-out annihilation is similar. I think the actual threat is different, and we need World War II kind of mobilization to get off of fossil fuels.
And that's the parallel. Maybe you do see.
That's the parallel. Like that is the kind. You know, I haven't done a whole lot of reading about World War II, but my understanding is that, you know, the whole country world was sort of. I guess I'll focus on the United States. People, everyone was contributing and sacrificing for the war effort, right? There was rationing on gas and there was rationing on food and people supplemented their own food with their gardens and there was a lot of responsibility and regulations in place and things the government did to support the war effort, et cetera. And that is the kind of mindset and the scale that we need to be acting to stop fossil fuel extraction and burning and transition to 100% renewable energy.
And Wendy looked at me when Neely said, I don't remember hiding under desk. Wendy said, I do.
Yeah. But what I think one of the interesting differences is this. When I was young, my mother got mail from ZPG, Zero Population Group. There are definitely ways in which what's happening to the climate is not entirely because of population, but the fact is that the way we live and the number of people who are living that way are part of the problem. So the question is not only the morality of bringing children into a world that is suffering. The world has suffered and will continue to suffer as long as human beings are human. It's more a question of, is there also a question of the additional burden on the system that is already ruining the climate? So that is a different issue. That is an additional issue that isn't there for nuclear war or some of these other threats. I also want to bring up, there's a real irony to the kinds of news we get. I see all these, the kind of news we get is we're making the planet uninhabitable. We're almost ready to go to Mars. we're almost ready to have medicine make us immortal. We're almost ready to self-edit our genes. It's almost like everything is coming at the same time, and we are really living the Chinese curse of living in interesting times. I think that it's a weird world out there. But when my child was born, I gave birth at Genesee Hospital, and I got my baby in the back seat, and I'm going up to Pinnacle Hill where we live at that time. And I'm watching people cross the street on Monroe Avenue. You guys live in this city, you know, they don't wait for the crosswalk. And I'm looking at these people and I'm saying, you know, if your mother saw what you were doing, you know, on the day you were born, if you knew how much she loved you, you would never take your life in your own hands just to get across Monroe Avenue. And I turned to my child and I said, look, you know, this humanity thing, it's bizarre. I mean, sorry to bring you into this weird group of people, but it's all I've got to give. You know, it is what it is. And don't blame me. I know you didn't ask to be born, but don't blame me.
Well, on that note, let's get our only break of the hour. And when we come back, we've got more of your phone calls and just a remarkable amount of feedback on the subject of parenting in the climate change generation, whether to have children and whether to have more children, and what to tell our children about climate change. You're hearing Wendy Lowe, who is a mother and a climate activist with Mothers Out Front and the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Neely Kelly is the New York senior organizer for Mothers Out Front. Larkin Posedlick is mother and executive director of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Steuben County. So parents with a lot of different perspectives. Here in studio, your emails and your phone calls, and we'll get back to those phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson, Friday on The Next Connections. In our first hour, a conversation about grade inflation. Some university admissions officers say that too many high school transcripts look the same, and teachers or even college professors are letting students retest or rewrite papers too often. We discuss it. Then second hour, Louis C.K. back in the headlines for his recent leaked comedy set. We talk about the limits of material for comedians. Welcome back to Connections. Woo, boy, we've had feedback from some emails from listeners who think this is the wildest conversation ever, and of course you should have children, and how could anybody even be questioning this? Whereas at least two other people have invoked David Benatar's book. He's a philosopher from the University of Cape Town. The book is Better to Never to Have Been, The Harm of Coming into Existence. So we've got a wide range of feedback on the subject of bringing children into the world, knowing that climate change is very much with us and a possible big, big problem. So let's go ahead and let's get back to your phone calls. And in Brighton, this is Milo. Go ahead, Milo. Hi, Milo. Go ahead. Are you there?
Oh, sorry. My phone was on mute. Sorry about that.
Oh, no problem. Go ahead.
So I wanted to talk about some of this aspect of personal responsibility that I feel like has been touched on a lot throughout the program, that, they making, you know, these massive changes in climate, you know, in carbon output, for example, you know, is a matter of like not eating meat or, you know, biking instead of driving or making these other personal lifestyle decisions, you know, chief among them with having kids, because I know there are a lot of people who argue that having kids is somehow related to a carbon footprint, you know, just because as humans, we all have a carbon footprint. But I guess I just wanted to underscore the fact that 70% of CO2 emissions right now come from industrial sources, and that until we address that, it's not going to be a matter of personal change. And in that context, like, I think that the question of whether or not to have kids, whether it's like good for the planet or good for ourselves, has a lot more to do with our own personal feelings, and that like the main thrust of how we're going to make change with climate has to do with a different front of like choice making.
Yeah, Milo, I think that's a really Fair point, and I'm glad you called. Thank you for that. And I see Neely Kelly nodding vigorously over there, so I'll start with you on this question. I think personal responsibility matters in all aspects of life. That's what I'm certainly teaching my son. But we probably are not going to reverse climate change just in terms of that. That there is a systemic component, and Milo brings that up here, and we kind of have to keep our mind on that. So knowing that's the case, what do you say to kids in the climate change generation about their own personal responsibility and what they might do to create systemic change? How are you doing it with yours?
So my kids are pretty aware of climate change.
I imagine they are.
But I try to let them just be kids and give them the option of going to rallies or speaking out or whatnot. Because I do want them to have a childhood. And I think what's really important, and I swapped some Facebook messages with someone this morning about this issue. I do think parents have a response. Parents now, or people considering being parents, have a tremendous responsibility to model more sustainable living than more sustainable living. And I know at our house, you know, we do that. We have the solar panels. We are a family of four. We have one car. You know, we conserve energy. We recycle. In fact, we didn't have hot water last week on vacation, and I was trying to fix it and had the water running. My 11-year-old, she turned it off, and I was like, "Why'd you turn it off?" She was like, "Stop wasting water." And I was like, "Oh, you're right. Thanks." so bringing them with that level of consciousness and awareness is really important. And I think, you know, reiterating Milo's point of the industrial pollution is what we have to target. And to me, I think she made this point, had the choice to have children, you know, for me, it's not about contributing a greater carbon footprint, because I already do that. Living in this country, in spite of all the things that we do, have a greater carbon footprint than, you know, X percent of people around the world. For me, it's about bringing, you know, sort of knowing what's coming and can I put that on a new life? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a really important distinction to make. And you know, people who choose to have children should not be blamed and shamed ever because, oh, you're increasing the carbon footprint, because she's exactly right. It is the corporate polluters. It is the industry that has brought about the vast majority of this change.
Let me get Larkin and Wendy. Larkin, as a parent of just a one-year-old, when you think about how to have these conversations as they grow older, I really appreciate, as a parent myself, Neely's point about raising kids who are aware and thoughtful while not trying to sort of strip them of their childhood. And that can be difficult. How do you view that, Larkin?
We talk about it a lot, and I agree 100% with Milo and Neely. It's about how we raise the kids in a world where there is so much industrial pollution and things like that. I come from a background in food and public health, and so even though our son is only a year and a half old, we are already trying to really raise him with the value of loving the world that he lives in and knowing where his food comes from. He's 18 months old, and he knows that when we drink milk, we say, "Thank you, cows, moo," because I want him to value the natural world. I want him to spend time outside. And I think for those parents who either have young kids, I always say that we're at the phase where we kept him alive for a year. Now we have to make him a good person. And so if there are parents out there who are worried about having kids and how do you do this, I think it's really just about raising kids who understand simplicity and are connected to nature, who recognize that we in this country do have too much, and so much of that excess is contributing to this in an industrial sense. And so if we can live with less, if we can not run the water, if by the time your kids are 11 they know to shut off the water, that's a really big step, even if it might seem like a little one, because you're raising a generation of kids who care about the world that we live in, not just for their own use, but care about the world for other reasons as well. And that, I think, is going to be a systemic change that can really make things happen.
Well, Pat writes to us on Twitter and says, I'm skeptical that anyone changes their family plans based on climate change, considering no one changes their vacation plans based on climate change. I suspect some, I think there's some food for thought there. I suspect some people amend vacation plans, but food for thought. That's fair enough. Wendy, you got your hand in the air.
Yeah, I amend my vacation plans. I make sure that I have enough time to take the train and build that in. I have not taken a plane ride down to visit my family in about 10 years and basically stopped thinking about taking planes in about 2001.
Wow. Let me try to fit in as many of your phone calls as we can here because we've just been overrun, which is a great sign of community interest in the subject. Jane in Rochester next. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, Evan, I agree with you when you said this is different. And to your audience, I would say if there's one important word, it's extinction of life on this planet we're talking about. We don't seem to make it the focus and the priority climate change that we would need to with that hovering over us. And time is very, very short. Thank you.
All right, Jane, thank you very much for that. Linda in Webster writes, I would like to hope that generations who come of age in anxious and uncertain times are more aware, more compassionate, and more willing to make a difference in the times they find themselves. But perhaps that is a function of how those parents react to change of any type. Again, on modeling for our own kids and thinking about how they encounter our reactions to that. Thank you, Linda, for that. I'll turn now to Hal in Sparta. Go ahead, Hal. Are you there, Hal?
Taking my call.
Yep.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. Yeah, I first was concerned about having children being a bit older. I'm guessing that most of you in the 60s, considering nuclear war was on everyone's mind. And then raising kids cooperatively, I waited until I was 40. I have now two great millennial kids. And they've been addressing climate change in their own specific ways. Raising cooperative kids isn't alone just enough, I felt. Fewer kids later in life using a small carbon footprint was my mantra. But my two kids grew up in our farm home, and with knowing there are 8 billion humans on the planet emitting greenhouse gases. So as young teens, they visited Germany biking around with relatives, and I stopped flying about that time. As adults, they went to Buffalo University and then graduate school in Cornell and Stanford. The one who went to Cornell worked on climate change in terms of addressing adaptation of New York City to Superstorm Sandy, and that's featured in the PBS.org, SinkingCities.org series. My daughter's work was involved in that, and my son went to Stanford where he co-authored with Professor Mark Jacobson two articles analyzing the feasibility of 100% renewable all-energy sector in 50 U.S. states, and then in October 2017, 100% renewable in 139 countries. And our New York State Sierra Club that I'm a leader in has supports these measures. In addition, passive design, just saving energy from new and retrofitting houses, makes a huge difference. And the problem, unfortunately, is there's no carbon tax-based funding addressing these complicated issues of sea level rise, design architecture, renewable power engineering, or major passive energy savings in retrofits. So I hope the current administration and Congressman Joe Morelli can address these. I worked for Nate McMurray here in the 27th district, but unfortunately he didn't win. So,
Hal, I got to jump in and just say thank you so much for that. What Hal laid out was a lot of possible progress, but also the challenge of policy, and those things can butt heads. And so one of the themes from this discussion about parenting and the climate change generation is about, you know, sort of not just whether to raise kids, but raising kids who understand the challenge and know how to change it. So in our last 90 seconds, I'll ask all three of you. Larkin, you know, 30 seconds apiece. Are you an optimist as a parent now, or do you find yourself becoming more pessimistic?
I have always been an optimist about almost everything in my life, but I think I am optimistic about this as well, because I think that we are headed towards a time of scarcity and limitation, but we can, if we raise our children right and organize in the amazing ways that Neely and Wendy are doing, we can turn that limitation into positivity and possibility, and we still have a chance to turn things around, maybe not entirely, but at least a little bit. And so I remain positive and optimistic that our kids can be the generation to do that.
Wendy, 30 seconds.
I'm an optimist every other day, and then the other days I just pray a lot.
Neely, go ahead.
That's something I actually try not to think about. The way I think about it is just doing the absolute best I can every second of every minute of every single day to make this world a better place. And, you know, just recognizing that's all any of us can do. And, you know, there's so much uncertainty. So I'll leave it at that.
Well, and I'll read Sarah's email to close the program. She says, great show. I wonder why mothers don't put the industrial 72% together with billions of people purchasing phones that are manufactured by industry or playing Fortnite on electronic devices, etc., run by pipeline electricity. In other words, we and our children drive and demand the industries. Mm. I say this reading it on a phone, but it's a good point. Sarah, our purchases, our actions do make some impacts, big impacts. I want to thank all of the listeners who contributed to this discussion. We'll post the article if you like, Parenting the Climate Change Generation. And Larkin Psedlik is right. David Wallace Wells, who wrote the piece, concludes by saying, quite literally, the greatest story ever told may well bring a happy ending, that our kids might be able to help bring this about. And then he's not giving up hope just yet. Larkin, thanks for the conversation. Thanks for joining us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Our thanks to Wendy Lowe and Neely Kelly in studio from Mothers Out Front. Thank you so much for being here.
Great to be with you.
Thank you. And our thanks to Gary Putup, helping out behind the glass, Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.